Anna Wanyonyi. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at wings.org. Wings thanks all our friendly supporters, including Genevieve Vaughn, Suzette Cullen, and your local community radio station. Wings makes programs available to stations free of charge. Inquire by email, wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With the help of our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute during our year-end campaign, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give and join the team.
Here we are once again on Film at 11, and we've got Ben Garbellano once again to talk a little bit more about James Bond movies, but specifically some of the toys and gadgets that he had. You know, one of the interesting facets of the series of movies is how they came up with things from the real world, like particular cars, and then they invented certain things or added things to those cars. But the primary car from the beginning was the Aston Martin.
Okay, so yeah, the Aston Martin DB5. At the time, I mean, it was more aerodynamic than most things that America was making. America was like starting with like the Corvettes, kind of starting to get in that scene. But America was making a bunch of big, heavyweight, bulky cars with big straight line sixes and introducing small block V8s. And then eventually later in the late 60s, getting into the big block V8s. I've never really connected the dots this way before, but partially I think there's a connection with like what Carroll Shelby was doing with racing for a British racing team and racing, you know, one of these very similar small sports cars that Americans had just never seen. They never built any cars that way. Everything, you know, since the 20s was just getting bigger and bigger and longer and more elegant lines and whatnot. But along comes kind of this new British era. The DB5 was, you know, they're always called back to the DB5, even to the latest James Bond movies. It was definitely vital piece of franchise history.
You know, what does DB stand for in its name?
The DB designation is from the initials of David Brown, who built up the company from 1947 onwards.
Aston Martin had been around since the end of the Second World War. It'd been around a long time. So the British were really early in getting the sports car silhouette moving on the highways, but they're probably pretty expensive cars, I assume.
Oh, I mean, now they've well into the $1 million range.
Well,
a 1965 DB5 has got to be worth well over a $1.5 million.
You know, talk about
probably in poor condition.
Talk about governmental overspending. You know, they just give him, in Goldfinger, for example, they just give him an Aston Martin to drive around, although they've outfitted it with various gadgetry, a bulletproof shield and an oil slick that can come out the back and befoul the undercarriage of a pursuing automobile and certain other things.
Headlight machine gun.
Oh yes,
which is awesome. And then, you know, like my personal favorite was the ejector seat for the passenger for any unwanted guests.
And what's funny is that they give it to him. They ship it over to I think it's Switzerland or someplace in Europe, and when he finally tracks down the factory, he uses all of those things in about 5 minutes, and then the car is wrecked.
Yes, he has all of these awesome gadgets, uses them all in probably less than 5 minutes of the film, and then is fooled by a mirror and crashes into a brick wall, going down a dead end alley.
That's crazy. And so that was about $1 million worth of car that he just, in today's...
Well, yeah, today's money, yeah, for sure. I mean, back then it was probably like a $7,500 car. I'd have to look up like what it was, you know, but $7,500 in 1964, 1965.
I'm looking at a list of some of the cars from the very first movie, Dr. No. There is a big reliance on cars that various people drive. A lot of Chevrolets and a LaSalle and a couple of Fords, but also a Vauxhall PA Velox. They must have done a lot of research to try to put the car with the appropriate person, be they a villain. For example, in Goldfinger, he has Goldfinger, the villain, has a golden Rolls Royce, if I remember right.
Yeah, I know for sure, at least like the radiator, the big old massive radiator on the front of it looks like it's all completely gold, which I think they do spend, you know, a bit with, you know, different trying to pair up the cars to the characters.
Yeah, so the Americans, when he's in Kentucky, it's just Fords and Chevys that the American people are driving around while Goldfinger himself has this bizarre Rolls Royce. But Felix Leiter, the American guy, drives a Ford Thunderbird, and Goldfinger also has a Lincoln Continental and a Ford Ranchero. So Oddjob drives the Ford Ranchero, and that's when they're squashing the car.
Yeah, that's actually like one of my dad's like funniest stories that he ever told me. It was that, you know, like that Ford Ranchero weighs like 5,000 or 6,000 pounds, and they just crush it into like a 3x3 or a 4x4 cubic block, and, you know, just drop it in the back of like an F-150 at the time, or I forget what kind of truck it actually is, but it's like they didn't have the payload to be able to drive off with a $6,000 car just sitting in the back of a flatbed.
Well, once the gold has been separated from the big cube, it probably weighs a little bit less.
Just a little bit. I forget what that was, $1 million in gold bullion, I think, is what the payout was for each one of those henchmen.
Yeah. Well, there have been some, there's not just regular cars, but sometimes there's really odd cars. I can't remember which movie it is, but I know it takes place, I think it's a Pierce Brosnan Bond movie, in which that takes place somewhere in the Alps or in the snow, and he drives a car that's made out of ice. Am I misremembering that?
It's not made out of ice. It has like retro reflective abilities, so it's an invisible car.
Oh, that's it. Okay. But the hotel he's staying in is made out of ice, if I remember.
The hotel, yes, the hotel is made out of ice. That's correct.
How impractical would that be? You know, one of the other fantastic features of the James Bond series is the set decoration. These immense lairs where the villains live and have their headquarters. But then here they have, which always seems like a really odd use of space. Hey, that reminds me, how come they don't give up? When it's really obvious that they've lost the fight, why do the minions just keep shooting and fighting? What do they get out of it? I don't get it.
Because they've signed up to go with whatever crazy ego crazy mastermind, you know, guy that wants to take over the entire world. You know, there's no coming back, you know, like it's, you're all in as a henchman once you're, you know, like Oddjob working for Goldfinger or Nick Knack working for Scaramanga, you know, he's not, you know, you can't like put that on your resume. I got the man with the golden gun killed. Who's hiring?
So they're true believers. Yeah. The invisible car, how long does that last in the movie before he gets destroyed by a ridiculous car chase?
I'm trying to remember if that one actually gets destroyed or not. To be honest, I mean that one also had a ejector seat that was a callback to the DB5 because he ends up like, I forget what it is. He's getting chased by like part of the villain's force and ends up like flipping the car upside down on ice and it's skidding around. And then they're shooting a missile at him, and he hits the ejector seat to flip the car over. And
Ooh.
Because he flips the car over, the missile goes straight past and hits like the other guy that was chasing him.
Ah, yes, of course.
But yeah, that one also had like, I'm trying to think, there wasn't too many crazy features on that one, but you know, I remember it had the good old retractable spikes in the tires.
Like on a chariot where they come out the side and shear the.
No, it was more like the studs approach
Oh, okay.
for like winter, but they were like, you know, very excessive. You know, like he like drives up almost near like a 45-degree ice wall at one point, you know,
Oh.
to.
Do you have a favorite car or automobile or vehicle from the whole series?
In Tomorrow Never Dies, he gets like this Ericsson phone in the very beginning. You know, Q is posing as like a Hertz rental agency guy, and he's checking out Bond with a BMW. I think it's a 750i, or you know, he's telling him about all the functions, and he's asking him if he needs extra insurance and you know all this stuff. But he has a cell phone that controls the car, and I mean at that time. It was absolutely crazy. And so he gets the car, he goes and does something, and he comes back to find all these guys trying to get into his car. And it's got, you know, like it's got like electroshock on it. And then it's got gas, like sleeping gas or something that comes out of it. It's got like missiles in the sunroof. But you know, so a couple of guys get shocked, they gas, he starts it up, drives it around with his phone, then like jumps in it.
Please fasten seatbelt.
Sitting in the back seat the whole time and just driving it in the back seat, you know, on his cell phone.
Reduce speed, pedestrians involved.
Shooting rockets at people. And then, you know, eventually, like, gets out of the car. The car drives up to the top of the parking garage and jumps out and crashes directly into the, like, the Hertz dealership, like, front-end window. Like, so that was really iconic for me growing up. You know, I mean, I think one of the ones that really also like really stood out was the Lotus in The Spy Who Loved Me, when he just drives straight off the dock.
Can you swim?
And the female Russian spy, like, it's like pretending to look worried. You know, and then, you know, the car transforms into a submarine.
Oh.
And that I think also had like a whole like oil ink spot to like, you know, like make it so people couldn't see where they were going and whatnot. But like the funny thing with the female Russian is she's like, at one point, like they're trying to evade people underwater, and she starts flipping switches.
How did you know about that?
I stole the blueprints of this car 2 years ago.
The Bond movies. In that regard, have predicted the future with the Elon Musk,
The
the Tesla,
Tesla.
like a Stanley Kubrick type of movie. They're anticipating the future from time to time because the people who are working on these movies are always thinking of the most advanced machinery and technology into the films in order to please the fans.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your favorite car, Doug?
Oh, I'm still fond of that Goldfinger car that he,
The Aston Martin DB5.
yeah, that he uses to death in about a minute and a half of screen time. But I remember it as being gray. Were all the Aston Martins color-coded? I mean, were they all gray, like the way a Ferrari is always red? Although I guess you could buy one if you're going to pay a
No,
billion dollars.
I think it was just the James Bond thing where it's just like they just use like that gray silver for a lot of cars.
Oh, okay. Maybe they're more photogenic or something, or less shiny, if
Yeah,
that makes
it could be a photography thing. I mean, it's also kind of like if it's not a bright silver, if it's just kind of like that gray kind of gunmetal-ish color, like you don't stand out, you know, in the 60s,
sense.
you know, where like the 60s was, you know, kind of like the resurgence of color and going into the 70s, you know, like going into the 70s of like the very generic like toned down yellows and reds and greens, where they were like they were a bit more they were more vibrant in the 60s, but I feel like in the 70s going into the 80s it became kind of monotone almost.
Well, what is the symbiotic relationship between the rise of the sports car in America and the James Bond movies? Because you mentioned that England was starting to move into the sports car market in a big way.
Yeah, England was giving Ferrari a run for their money in Le Mans, and it was the beginning of the time of the Cobra coming to market, of American muscle developing the way from family sedans and station wagons and you know, really just kind of bringing into that sports scene a bit. And, you know, James Bond was for sure, like, just with all the different fun toys and showing off, you know, these big old Thunderbirds and the kind of the beginning of American muscle. It's
the earliest American sports car or sporty style car I can think of is a Ford Mustang. That was innovative, was it not? I mean, earlier cars, you mentioned earlier that cars from the post-war era in America were getting bigger and heavier, also probably more gas guzzly. But at the same time, smallness becomes a goal at a certain point. You know, things switch and suddenly everything gets smaller. TVs get smaller and portable. Computers get smaller and smaller. And thus with the cars, for example, the little Sunbeams and MGs that would from time to time see them on the streets. And the Mustang, did it seat four people or just two in the front seat? I can't even remember.
Well, it's at four people.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, going back, I would say, like, for American, you know, the Corvette was probably the first one.
That's right. Yes.
In the mid to late 50s. And that was kind of sleeking it up. But, you know, the Mustang was kind of Ford's attempt to make something a little different, but still just using the complete chassis from another car.
Oh. You know,
all that they did is just put a new design, and they put, like, a small, I believe it was a small straight six into it. So when it even came out, it kind of, you know, like, while it was very attractive and new looking, you know, the Ford Mustang 64.5, you know, was pretty underpowered in the way of, if you look at how fast between 64 to say 69, how quickly they went in developing bigger engines and the small block V8s and the big block V8s and dropping them in cars. But at the same time, you know, like with Chevy, they put a, you know, a 396 or something, or, you know, some massive big block engine, but then the car couldn't corner worth a damn.
Oh,
and I think that's kind of where this European influence started coming into America, because they had these cars that could corner and they were fast, they were agile and quick. And everybody wanted something different, you know, because if you grew up in the 50s, if you were automotively inclined, you could keep up with every new model of car. You know, there were not that many manufacturers. It's not at all like what we had today. Imports barely existed back then. Everything was about American exceptionalism and American production. And so, like, all of a sudden, you know, I mean, like, think about, like, The Graduate.
Oh, yes.
You know? Dustin Hoffman's driving around in a car, Alfa Romeo, made for the movie, you know?
I didn't know that.
I don't know for sure that they made the car for the movie, but it was an Alfa Romeo Graduate. That's what it was called. And I think it wasn't made for the movie, but it was like a step up, kind of the way, like, what is it? I think GMC kind of had their different levels of cars, where it's like, oh, you know, you made salesman, you get this, or now you're a manager and you're responsible. You get up to the next pay grade, kind of thing.
And there's so many different kinds of cars for different purposes. For example, there's obviously working trucks. There are family type cars. There's touring cars. I assume that those, if you're wanting to see the USA in a Chevrolet, then you get a car that can just drive for hours. But the James Bond cars, it's a lifestyle car.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, the Aston Martin DB5 is a GT, which GT stands for Grand Touring.
Okay.
You know, so it's built as a car to be driven around the countryside and make a trip out of it and have fun with and but have fun during the process.
Yeah.
Have fun taking corners and accelerating and braking and that not just a point A to point B functional car. It was built for pleasure. It was built for purpose of enjoying the driving experience.
Now, does a car expert or car buff prefer a manual transmission, or do they just kind of live with the fact that automatic transmissions have more or less taken over standard engineering?
You know, I think it's a personal preference, you know, and it could depend a little bit on age. You know, my very first car was a manual car. I've always owned a manual car.
Mm.
You know, at this point with technology, even the paddle shifting cars, it shifts so much faster than what you could physically do as a human, no matter whether you're the best racer in the world at any given point.
Yeah.
You know, some of this technology is far superior, but there is no feeling like having more control of pushing in the clutch and changing gears and accelerating or deaccelerating or rev matching. I feel like for me, that's the ultimate pleasure of driving is having that ultimate control. Whereas, you know, the only time it sucks is when you're in stop and go traffic.
Yeah.
You know, that is the only time I'm in my manual car and I'm like, you know, an automatic would be real nice, you know, when I'm crawling for the next 20 minutes, you know.
And then also when you're taking a lot of vast curves in a mountainous area, you know, you can downshift and upshift and really just let the car is just this an external part of your body. And then especially with certain sports cars, is there an optimum distance from the ground to the body of the car itself? I mean, can a car be too low to the ground, or perhaps even worse, too high up off of the ground?
You can definitely be too high off the ground. Too low is probably going to depend on exactly, you know, the way the body is molded and what the airflow looks like, because you do want to have airflow both under and over the car. But, you know, the more airflow over the car will impact downforce, and in some, you know, in cases where like you have a big heavy front engine car, the rear end is going to be much lighter, and so being able to grab some of the downforce at the back of the car where the power is actually going to those wheels gives it more pressure, more traction, in order to accelerate out of a corner, for instance.
Oh boy, this has been really educational. We've been talking to Ben Garbellano, and he's not just a James Bond expert, but clearly an expert on automotives. And gosh, who knows what else you're a fan, an expert on that we can explore in the future. But yeah, so this is a part two of our little James Bond series in celebration of the November. Oh, I don't know if it's a birthday or not, but the traditional month of November is the month of the James Bond.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I think it one of the Ted Turner stations, TBS, they always called it the Bond Station.
The Bond Station, yeah, that's fantastic.
Tonight on TBS, Spectre holds the world hostage, and only James Bond can stop them. 7 days of 007 continues with Thunderball. Tonight at 10:35 Eastern, only on...
It kind of went all the way through the holidays. I felt like it kind of lingered.
Yeah.
You know, like it was one of the only cable stations that you could watch that didn't fall into the Thanksgiving theme or the Christmas theme. And it was like, no, we're going to have action for guys. So there's actually something entertaining to watch besides when there's not football on. Or
I know.
Tomorrow on the Superstation. It's what you love about Bond.
Really?
First at 12:50. The Spy Who Loved Me. Then at 3:35. With the golden gun, the ultimate. ultimate 007 viewing experience. 13 days of 007. Tomorrow, 12:50 Eastern. Super Bowl is on the Superstation.
Gosh, I can't even think of a James Bond movie that even references Christmas or really any other holiday. So they're pretty holiday neutral, which is a great thing to have when you're inundated or overfed on holiday.
Yeah, the only one I can think of is I think it's The World Is Not Enough with Denise Richards, and it's literally just one of the zany jokes at the end. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to air this, Doug, but there's one of the zany jokes at the end because she's Dr. Christmas Jones, right?
Oh, that's...
And like when they first meet, she's like, don't make any smart remarks because I've heard all the jokes. And she's like, I don't know any doctor jokes, you know, like, but at the end of the movie, but other than that, I don't really recall ever seeing Christmas in a James Bond movie. It would be nice to talk about gadgets like a little more to see. With gadgets, there's like the most ridiculous gadgets, and then there's like the coolest gadgets, right? Yeah. There's like, it's the one where he's got the duck as the hat and he's wearing the scuba tank system. Mm. You know, like, and it's like, you know, like he's coming in there, like and the duck is like, everybody's looking at the duck. They're not looking at the guy that's right directly below him, you know, and somehow he's wearing a whole scuba suit that like, and he's got a suit that's completely pressed perfectly when he takes it off and his hair looks perfect, you know.
I think that sounds like Goldfinger.
I think that is the beginning of Goldfinger, but then it's like in Thunderball, right after that, he's got like a device that's like about the size of like three pins, and he can just breathe out of that thing, you know.
That's that thing, yeah. And also, yeah, the first gadget I remember is the completely weaponized briefcase that he carries from Russia
with the attaché case. I thought that one was pretty cool, even like growing up, you know, in the 80s, you know, seeing that, it's like, I thought that was pretty cool, you know, I probably didn't see that movie until probably 1990 or something like
that. Oh, really?
But, you know, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's got gold, it's got knives, it's got press gas, you know.
And also it introduces one of the great fight scenes of all time. Extremely well choreographed fight scene, and unique because it's set in such a small space, you know, two connecting bedrooms in a train compartment. I just never, it's never really seen a competing and there's so many fight scenes in so many movies that for one to stick out, that's a really big deal.
You've been listening to DK Home in conversation with Ben Garbolano about what they like about the James Bond movies. Ben and DK will be back in a future episode of Film at 11 to talk more about their favorite film series. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. We'd like to thank those people who've gone to kboo.fm/give and shown their support for non-commercial community radio. Film at 11 will return next week. So until then, keep watching the screens.
I know how to hurt. listening to KBOO Portland.
What is that terrible racket?
It's Radio Lost and Found on every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from local